This is episode 30 of season 17 of Geek Speak. Hi, I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm speaking with Mr. Miles Elam. He's here in person. It's been a while. Hi, Miles. Thanks for joining me on Geek Speak.
Glad to be back from that hiatus.
Yeah. What'd you do with your time while I was busy gallivanting in Wyoming?
I found ways to occupy my time from your away from your grandiose presence.
Was it nice to have a break? Or did you miss talking
to
the people?
No, I miss talking about it.
Yeah? You like talking about this kind of stuff,
yeah.
Right? If you didn't like it, why would we do it? Well, I first...
Over and over again.
I do want to apologize because in the excitement of seeing you again, I neglected to record the last 20 minutes of our conversation. So we're going to do that again. But for all the peoples at home, it'll sound fresh and rewarding. Right, Miles?
Yes.
Hey, Miles. Do laptops help children learn? I better not have that tone the entire time.
No, you really shouldn't.
Tell me about what's going on in Maine and such.
Maine is the only school that has a statewide laptop policy.
Only state that has a school laptop-wide policy. Yes, okay. Meaning that they force laptops or no laptops?
It's just a school policy that all students will have laptops.
Cool.
What they have found, to very few people's surprise, is that just plopping a laptop in front of a kid sitting on their lap is not actually going to help them learn better.
So it's not just like a magic panacea kind of thing.
It is not.
That's a bummer.
Laptops are not a panacea. Technology is not a panacea. Now, at the same time, when laptops were used in a focused curriculum for like math and science, they did see noticeable gains.
Okay. So when the curriculum was designed around the laptop,
and
only math and sciences.
Well, those are ones they specifically saw a benefit.
Because the people that were teaching math and sciences knew how to take a curriculum
that
and use it on
a
computer.
That may well be a good portion of it.
How long have they been requiring laptops in classrooms?
15 years.
That's a long time. That's like a whole undergrad. That's good.
Yep, that's enough time to gather some data. Now, you know, the laptops or the computers, you know, have varied in quality over that period of time.
Sure.
But yes, they have had enough time to gather that information and to get some realistic conclusions from it.
So I just love that it's like, it's kind of depressing because what it basically means is, yeah, if you've got good teachers, it'll work. I mean, that's true with everything. You could be like, here, we have a new thing called paper, and it will help students learn if you have good teachers.
But I mean, if you have good teachers and a laptop,
it's better than just good teachers.
Yes. And you know, that goes without saying. Technology is an amplifier. It doesn't do good or bad on its own. It amplifies whatever's there. So if you have a mediocre curriculum and you add laptops to them, it's going to remain mediocre. If you have a bad curriculum and you add laptops, it's going to be just as bad or worse. And if you have a good curriculum and you incorporate the technology with that, it can improve things.
I had an interesting experience watching my children use the software for doing math. The way that the software they're using in the schools, or partially using for math, allows them to take guesses at the answer quickly. So they can just put in numbers, right? And sometimes there's actually multiple choice. And if they fail too many times in a set, the set gets kind of re-scrambled and they start in the beginning again. So one of the tactics the kids have done is go through, when they run into a really hard problem, they skip it. They go through all of them. They'll go back to the hard problem and they'll guess through them. But additionally, they can answer these extremely quickly, which I found interesting. Like they're, instead of working the problem out, which of course is the intent, is to grab a piece of paper and work out these problems, they figure out the tricks in the system and are doing it. And at first, this frustrated me and showed me that I had this idea that, well, the software is obviously stupid. If you're not making – if you want the student to practice by putting it on paper and you have software that's not causing them to actually do that work that way, it's kind of failing. But at the same time, if they start producing an intuition around math because they're doing a lot of this, maybe it doesn't matter that they're not working out the problems. And I keep on going back and forth this. Now, all three of my kids are doing really well in math. But then again, maybe they're not learning anything. I don't really know.
Yeah, that's the funny thing about math, though. When we were in school, or at least in the same age, we didn't go to the same school. I remember teachers saying you can't use a calculator, you know, on the problems or the tests, and people go like, why can't we use a calculator? And the answer was always,
you might not have it when you need it.
You won't always have the calculator with you. And now we have, you know, smartphones, and we do have a calculator with us at all times. But
especially
it does
in classroom where you also have a laptop with you.
But the way we teach math maybe does require some change, because math is not about, or at least math at any real workable level,
mm-hmm.
is not about arithmetic,
right?
Or even basic, you know, algebraic functions. It's learning how to see the world, how to decompose it into a set of small steps,
yeah,
and then work through that problem. So algebra isn't necessarily how to do math per se, or how to solve a problem, but learning how to be literate in solving problems, so that you can, if you write it down, then you can break it down into smaller pieces and then work on it that way. And that way, math is really useful. And if they are getting it on an intuitive level, that's great.
That's kind of my thought. Is like, well, because they're doing so much repetitive, like they're doing these problems over and over again, there is something else being learned there. It's interesting. But they're also learning about the system that they're trying to use. And of course, a lot of our life is trying to figure out systems and figure out what they're trying
right.
to ask.
But so, there was a problem with regard to how math is taught a lot of ways, which is it's the same type of problem each time. So you become just formulaic about when this word is in this place and this word is in this place, it just becomes this formula and you plug it in and you go, as opposed to actually understanding a problem and not knowing ahead of time how it's supposed to be solved.
I had this experience with my middle child who's doing some area of solids, so three-dimensional solids, surface area. And she had some formulas, and she likes math. She's excited by it. And she has some formulas for stuff, and she was asking, she's like, Dad, I can't, this one's not working. And it, you know, it's a prism with an equilateral base, and the area of the base is this, and she's like, I don't know how to figure out the sides of that base. I'm like, oh, you probably don't need to figure out the sides of that equilateral, because finding out the area of an equilateral triangle, or finding out the base length, or the edge length of an equilateral triangle based off its area is not intuitive without you and I can work that out, but it's a little bit more than she's going to do in this classroom, right? And
wait, the surface area of a pyramid, is it? Or?
This was, she was actually trying to find the surface area of a prism, which is actually from what I gather,
when you say a prism, that doesn't,
it doesn't mean anything to me either, but actually what they're using the term prism is a pretty correct way of doing that.
Okay.
Take any polygon and extend it in a three-dimensional space in a straight way. So just take any polygon, two-dimensional, and put it on a table and then bring it up high.
Okay.
That's a prism. So it's a cylinder. A cylinder is a version of that, right?
Okay.
That's what the term they were using, right? So at first I was like, no, if they're talking about a prism with a polygon base, they're not talking about anything else. So it must be a four-dimensional die, you know, a 4D die, like a pyramid shape, three-dimensional pyramid is what I thought they meant. And she did it that way. It didn't work out. And then, of course, one of the bases is up, so there's all prisms have two bases. And I'm like, didn't know that about, that's the term they use for what that shape type is, what a cylinder type shape is. But in any case, the trick about these things in my mind was actually learning that. The math, of course, is kind of rudimentary. Once she realized what they were trying to ask her, then she got it. But the cool thing is, she and I both know what they mean by a prism now. And we're not going to fail, because it wasn't declared, but the problem failed in all other shapes except for this one shape, because she automatically got the answer. As soon as you put it in, they're like, nope, you're wrong. Instead of having her put it in wrong, the teacher correct it and say, nope, it's wrong. She got the feedback right away and knew that, oh, it's not a pyramid shape. It's something else.
Yeah.
And that was, like, I think, pretty edifying.
Yeah.
So no, I think the problems are actually written pretty well. Shall we move on from your story about Maine schools?
Absolutely.
Well, I know you think very highly of voting, electronic voting machines, right?
Not so much.
And electronic voting companies. What would you think if I told you, again, the second time tonight, that they don't always do security really well? Electronic systems and software, ES&S, were running voting machines in Chicago. And they had a database of 1.8 million people in Chicago. And the reason we know their database had about 1.8 million people is because cybersecurity firm UpGuard happened to run across all that data on an Amazon Web Service device or a cloud instance mm-hmm. without any kind of protection, as in, can I please read the data? Sure, here you go. Here's 1.8 million
effect,
data.
Yeah, side effect of that being that someone else could have seen that and they have no idea who would have grabbed it.
And UpGuard's actually a pretty good company. What they did is they reported it immediately to the company. The company then took it offline, secured it, and then UpGuard reported it out in the wild. Now, of course, yes, somebody else could have found that. In fact, it makes sense that if UpGuard's doing it for, I guess, kind of to bring a light, maybe it's a press thing for them. I'm not sure why a security firm would be doing that, just nature. But I can imagine other people that might want to steal identities might want to do this, because it turns out that the data that was there was people's names, their addresses, their date of birth, and partial social security number, and sometimes the driver's license or state identification. So everything you'd need to steal their identity. Kind of depressing.
Yeah. And it's really depressing that the security for voting machines, by and large, does not rise to the level of security for a slot machine.
That is kind of depressing, considering we have a lot more slot machines than voting machines.
Because there are regulations for how a slot machine functions, not just from the casino, but from like actual... You know, Nevada gaming regulations,
right. So
for example.
Okay, so the first time we talked about this story, you mentioned that, and I just got the idea that, well, yeah, of course, the gaming industry doesn't want to lose money on people hacking into their vending mm-hmm. machines. So of course they're going to make it secure. But you're saying that it's actually also regulated to the point that it has a percentage odds that are within strict patterns, right? Like they have to have a return of like 98.1 or whatever percentage mm-hmm. it is, right? So they're actually mandated that way by the Gaming Commission. You'd think that we could at least have that kind of mandation about people's security. And the thing that's so frustrating about this, the data that was lost, it's not their voting, it's not their whether they voted or not, it's their actual personal information. So the question I have is why was this voting machine software, why do they even have the individual's user information? They don't need that. Like the way that our voting system works here in California.
Their vote tallies and whether they voted weren't, or actually whether they voted or not, who knows, but that was up there. But the actual votes were not
associated, not on there, no.
But at the same time, we're talking about this amplification technology amplifying that 1.8 million voters all in one big chunk all together.
That'd be a really big book.
Which if you go with standard voting practices, and where you fill out a paper ballot, you know, fill out a modified, you know, glorified Scantron test, and you fill out your signature in the logbook.
Where first comes that you come up and there's a big book, and then you say to the person,
"No, first you go, which precinct are you in?"
Right, right.
And you look up, you know, what your address is, and go to the right table.
Election, what?
No, it's that table over there.
Right. and then there's a book that has your name on it, and you sign at that location saying, "I was here," and you put your signature down. So later, there's kind of like somebody wasn't impersonating you, and of course, you can't go and vote twice. Like that's the whole point of that thing. But that's completely separate from your vote. Like, there's no reason to correlate those.
You're right. And at the same time, how many of these logbooks would you have to collect from how many precincts to equal up to 1.8 million voter records?
You know, and if you did that, you would have to, like, have a serious truck, and then you'd have to have, like, a giant staff of people.
You'd have to have collusion with a variety of different areas.
You'd have, like, 100 people doing it, and it would take you a month. Like, it's, like, it's... Anyway, yes, you're right. In the paper form, the thing I don't understand is why is the voting company, the company that's actually tallying the votes and doing all that, why do they have any copy of the user information? More than that, why'd they put it on Amazon and make it public? Like, that was stupid. But I don't know. It just, it's aggravating that this kind of complexity exists and that we're not doing it right. The other aspect of this is, how much more efficient does voting have to be? Why does it have to be a quick thing? Why can't we vote and like 7 days later have a total?
Yeah, that's the whole thing of like we vote in for president in November, early November, and
months
the president
later
take over. And
in every office,
there's a historical reason for this. It used to be the voting was in November, and then they took office in March. And that was the amount of time it took to tally all the votes, and then for the person who may be living in a far state to move all their stuff and all the people over there. And today in our modern world, it's like how much time does it take to really tally, even if you use the slowest method possible
of just
writing down on a ballot and having people, precinct managers,
and I've mentioned this on the show before, there's this great series of science fiction that talks about like futuristic societies that people are allowed to vote quickly, basically by having smartphones, right? It's prior to smartphones existing, but the idea that like right now, if you wanted to do a tally on Facebook and ask, you know, 700 people to vote, you could get an answer, a relatively good answer within, I don't know, an hour. Like it's actually extremely easy to do this kind of thing. But the truth of the matter is, I don't really want voting to be a fast thing, especially when it affects our society. We want the whole idea of terms and like people thought and running and having stances is to have a thoughtful process around it. So speeding any of that up doesn't help any of that.
Yeah, Oregon, I think, has got it right. It's 100% vote by mail.
Yeah.
Everyone has a mail-in ballot. You do it. You put it in.
How about Australia, where you're fined if you don't vote?
There are a few countries that are like that. And
they have some, I'm not so into that, but I kind of get the idea.
They have some drawbacks, which is you end up with a whole lot of folks that are voting and
– from Mickey Mouse?
Yeah. Or just going like, oh, that guy's taller.
Yeah.
But at the same time, did we do all that much better?
No, not really. In any case, this wonderful company, UpGuard, I want to give them some props for doing this. They found vulnerabilities in the NICE system and also like 14 million Verizon customers. So they've been doing a good job of helping protect our data. So thank you, cybersecurity firm UpGuard. And boo to Electronic Systems and Software, ES and S. The other thing is, just because this was only vulnerability, and I say only vulnerability in people's personal user information and not their voting history, I don't trust that that's not knowable as well by the systems in place. Tell me about what Google has done recently with images.
Ever go to those stock photo sites?
Sure. Yeah, to look for pictures?
Yeah. And many of them have a watermark on top of them. So the company logo, overlaid on top of the image so that the idea is that you don't just copy the image off the site and then use it, that you go, oh, this is something I need to pay for.
Right.
Well, some Google researchers have made an algorithm that can remove watermarks from photos. So the way that many stock imagery sites like Adobe Stock, put the watermarks on ends up being a predictable pattern that can be found through heuristics.
And they normally make the watermark be semi-transparent or some other way not blocking the picture, because you want to know what the picture is. Mm-hmm. If you're going to buy it, you need to know what it is, right? So you don't want to like cover it up. And I'm assuming that almost all of these are done algorithmically, like in the sense that I've got the picture that I want to sell and I've got this watermark I'll just put over the entire thing.
So if you can determine the watermark... and what they've done is not just trying to find the watermark itself, but like manually and then have it be removed after the fact. It's the heuristic actually finds the watermark and identifies what it is and then removes it from a group of photos.
So you like give it 5,000 pictures and all of them, or some, you know, 200 of them have the exact same watermark. Yeah. Then it's pretty easy to figure out what the watermark's doing effectively to the image and just remove that.
Yeah. And reverse that process. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine that it's almost like I could do that manually through Photoshop if I knew Photoshop well enough. But algorithmically, it'd be a lot easier, of course.
I think I could do it.
I wouldn't be able to write a generic one, but I could definitely write one.
Yes, I could do a one-off.
Yeah, I could do a one-off.
I could figure out what the watermark looked like, take their company logo, because that's really what it is most of the time.
Take their company logo, scale it, and re-add the saturation, whatever it is.
Or just do a difference.
Yeah. Well, especially since you have
a
pixels.
The layer difference.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would probably do it.
It probably would. Doesn't even sound like that complicated a problem. So what are they going to start doing? Twisting them and mutating them and stuff? But the other thing is that, does it really matter? Because these stock companies are making money off people using their images. And whether they use the image illegally or not, whether they copy the image and use it or they pay them and use it, the image is being used by the company. The company can still find that image and find the company. Like, there's still other ways to receive the data. But also, I think most of the time, if you're a company making money on a site and you use an image, you're okay with paying a little bit of money. It's more accidentally that you might use an image because you're like, I'll just copy it and then no one pays them.
Well, one way that hypothetically Google could use this is being able to remove watermarks or remove minor additions to an image on a site as part of the reverse image search. So even if the image has been altered in some way, like adding some text or whatnot, that that could be removed and you can go back to the original image and then find out, like, yes, this is the original source.
Wait. So they could use it in their search system so that they could remove the
so they could find sites that have that image, but they've added a watermark.
Oh,
and then programmatically remove it again to then identify it correctly as, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
That one.
So you're talking about, so if a company like incorrectly watermarks something claiming they owned it, even though they didn't.
Yeah. Or someone just, swipes an image and then puts something on it so that it'll be fooled by that reverse search because it won't have the same hash.
I was thinking about like all the pictures of the famous, famous areas around, and like you go to like Yellowstone, you take a picture of some area that's very common and everyone has pictures of that. There are so many copies of images of that location, especially if you don't have clouds in there, mm-hmm. that at some point you have to question whether anyone can copyright it. Because like, how different can a picture be of the exact same thing if there's, I would assume there's 2 million pictures of like Old Faithful, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though Old Faithful is different every time it launches, but like let's say a rock that's near Old Faithful or something. There's probably 2 million copies of that photo. Can you really claim unique ownership of one of those copyrights? I don't know if that's even possible.
But for stock photo sites, one thing that is important about this is whenever researchers, whether it be Google researchers or someone else, comes up with a proof of concept when they're able to do something, that means it's going to hit the mainstream in a few years.
Right. There'll just be an app, but just to be a button, a Chrome extension that just does that for you.
Which means those sites really do need to step up their game because soon it's going to become normal for someone to be able to go there and just remove the watermark.
How long will it be before I can say, hey, I want a picture of a man holding a bowl of spaghetti in an apartment with a wood floor and a Dalmatian in the corner, and then the computer composites that image completely artificially from just knowledge. And then you go, no, I want the background of the room to be this color, and the dog should be in a happier position. Like, relatively soon, we'll be able to create images like that.
Mm-hmm.
And probably via voice.
The component pieces may or may not be copyrighted.
Well, that's the thing is the component pieces, if you have an algorithm that detects Dalmatians, you can then create a Dalmatian. You can create a lot of Dalmatians. Because if the algorithm thinks that it's a Dalmatian, it is a Dalmatian.
Now, that has some really chilling repercussions.
How so?
News items. Someone could describe a scene however they want, and that becomes the news story?
Yeah. No, and of course, like right now, recreating voice is relatively simple. Recreating video is getting easier. I mean, it's kind of disturbing how easy it would be to create content.
Now you're just working off of reputation.
Yeah, reputation is all it's about anyway. So you were talking about Google. Another amazingly great company is Microsoft. They actually have a search engine called Bing. And a while ago on this program, I said, I should switch to Bing because I haven't used it. And I switched my browser to Bing in Chrome for my personal account. And I still have it set to Bing. And it doesn't matter. It works fine. I actually a few times have like went, oh, I can't get what I need. And I go over to Google. But it's like the image search tool is slightly different. But in general...
Does Bing give answers?
Let me see. Like, what can I answer? Ask a question.
How far is it from Earth to the moon?
It gives me a response from space.com. It says, at perigee, its closest approach, the moon comes as close as 255,623 miles. So not the same way as Google responds. Yeah, not that. Is that a Wolfram Alpha response? Or is that just Google?
This one, it has a snippet from Wikipedia, and I think it just grabbed that data from Wikipedia.
This is an answer, and it says improve the answer. Is this answer helpful? And if I click yes, it's telling me. But yeah, so Bing is giving this answer. It's just getting that question answer from not, yeah.
Yeah, because Google actually answers that answer. You have a really, you have a picture of the moon followed by really bold, big text saying 238,900 miles. But that's the thing, though, is,
yeah, Bing is
when I'm looking
right?
at Bing, Bing is a snippet write-up that they pull, a paragraph they pulled.
They did. But they assume that write-up is appropriate answer to my question, which it kind of is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Whereas Google is going, is, this is the answer to the question you just asked.
You can use it for, how many...
And Google also has the people also search for the sun, which is 92.96 million miles, and Sirius, which is 8.611 light years, and Europa, which is 390.4 million miles.
The other thing is, like, how many fluid ounces in a gallon? Oh, it gives me a conversion unit back. So Bing also gives me conversion units, just like Google does. Okay. So anyway, I've been using it for a while, and it's not... It hasn't caused me to switch back. Like, if I was frustrated with it, I'd obviously switch back.
Sure.
One of the reasons I did this is that Google has owned the search space for a long time.
Yes.
And ever since Alta Vista days, I don't know if you remember that. That was my search engine prior to Google. Mm-hmm. DuckDuckGo people talk about all the time. And I decided, well, I'll just try
it. And DuckDuckGo was a response to wanting to have the same, similar search results as Google, but without the privacy concerns.
Right. And Google obviously has privacy concerns. I don't know if Microsoft's doing any better. Probably not. But what's interesting is that Bing is bigger than you think. Do you know how big Bing is for searches in the U.S.? Let's say percentages.
Bigger than a bread box?
Supposedly, it's 33% of U.S. searches, which seems exceptionally high to me until you think that actually Bing is powering AOL and Yahoo. So,
and is the default search engine to
for Microsoft.
For Firefox, I believe.
Firefox as well at this point?
Firefox stopped going from using Google as their default search engine a while back.
Yeah. So in any case, it's impressive that since... I think in 2015 it became profitable. So it's been around for a while, but not profitable for a while. So its growth rate's pretty quick. But when you count for default, I didn't know about Firefox. Default for Firefox, default for a new Windows install, and also for AOL and Yahoo. And we know AOL is actually a large beast because it's still profitable, even though it only people are still paying for dial-up through that you don't use through AOL. In any case, globally, the company is claiming 9% market share in searches. And then in different areas like Taiwan, they're at 24 to 26%. In the UK, they're either 23 to 25%. So in any case, it's kind of interesting to see Microsoft kind of succeeding in that space. Mm-hmm. And I would assume it's because of default installs. But at the same time, it's not noticeably different and worse. The other thing that's interesting is that because I'm using Chrome and I'm using my work computer for my personal usage as well as for work, I have two profiles, right? I have my personal profile, which uses Bing, and I have my work profile, which is using Google. And so I'm kind of toggling between them all the time, and I relatively rarely notice a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So in any case, I thought that was kind of interesting, and especially because the market share is
growing. As time has gone on, search is becoming more and more a commodity, I do have to admit. And now you're looking at where else can you go, and that's where you see the diversification, the Office suites that are now online, Microsoft with their Office 360 is now
you know,
trying to get in that space as well. And they've owned the Office space pretty much, but now they're getting the pressure from Google, which is
Google's kind of kicking their butt in the Office space, I'm assuming.
Well, online, yeah. But still, most people have access to Word. I don't think they've really made that transition yet.
I don't have access to Word anymore. Do you?
Yeah, but are we typical?
No, we're not typical. But I think at the same time,
I mean, Netflix Google standardized Docs, on the Google suite, though. I mean,
a lot of people have Google accounts, and a lot of people therefore have access to Google Docs. Mm-hmm. And they are kind of easy to use. Speaking of Google Docs and such, one of the things I was thinking earlier when we were talking about math and education is that I'd almost rather have my... a high school graduate really understand how to use a spreadsheet software and balance their checkbook and understand what finance charges are on credit cards, mm-hmm. like fully understand that scope of math in the sense that that's under math at some level, mm-hmm. and be able to use that to manage their money than to find the surface area of a prism.
I think they're solving two different problems. I don't think that you should sacrifice one for the other. I think they're both equally important.
That finding the surface area of a solid is just as important as balancing your checkbook.
I think
in
being
this
able
society.
To recognize physical shapes in the world and being able to act upon them to know, a volume, to know a length, to be able to calculate items.
I highly disagree with you. I think that our lack of understanding of basic accounting practices and the way that all of us are in the U.S. especially are in debt all the time and run and pay all these monies to banks and institutes because we don't know how to deal with credit card transactions and how to deal with our money, I think that's much more important than being able to find a surface area of something.
See,
when are you going to use the surface area of something? Use the accounting stuff all the time.
When you say all the time, it's...
You should be using it all the time. Or you're not managing your money. I mean, if you make money and you pay bills, you should be able to handle you should be able to know how to deal with your finances.
Yes, and that's basic arithmetic, which I think is an earlier.
It's not basic arithmetic. It's managing money. It's more complicated than that.
It's the application of math, and that's something we are missing. That's something I was talking about before. I think we are missing the application of math, like why math exists. It's not just arithmetic, just in doing a series of exercises in a book.
Yeah.
It's how you relate to the world. And one of the ways you relate to the world is by finance. Another way you relate to the world is being able to, you know, calculate your surroundings. If you're trying to, and it depends upon what you're doing, but if you're trying to figure out, like, will this fit in my room? How big is this? What's the angle of
that? If you get really good at your accounting and managing your money, you make more money, you save more money, you pay somebody to figure that out for you. No. I mean, I can't say that learning general, you know, geometry and math in general is a bad idea. I don't believe that at all. I just think if I had to have a person graduate high school and have one of these two skills, I'd rather have them have a really good, strong understanding of how to manage money than to figure out where to put their furniture in the bedroom.
And see, I think of it as math. They have the skills to manage money, but without any skills to actually make the money that they're going to be managing, because they've been limited to just managing money. Something else that you brought up earlier that I just wanted to touch on, which is a while back, I used to have this thought process of people making a spreadsheet and trying to do some really complicated things and going, oh, well, I could write a program that would do exactly what they were asking for as a dedicated, you know, app.
Yep.
Of some type. And
there are many businesses that have done just that.
Yes. Yes. And I have recently come upon a bit of an epiphany that I was completely wrong in this thinking.
How so? I mean, first off, I totally believe you're wrong. And that's fully...
If you can do 99% of what you need in that spreadsheet, like
you've
made it up and you're done. There is no point to having a dedicated app for it. You've already made it so this thing gets added up with all the rows here, yep, and this goes over to here, and then this makes the chart over here. You're done.
Right.
If you need more than that, you go to the app. But if you don't...
But that's the other thing, is that one of the problems with making an app is you've solidified the current work problem into something. Mm-hmm. What if they want to then change it slightly or do something different? I mean, having...
And that's the key point, is that making an app requires the specialist knowledge.
Yeah.
A spreadsheet is a generalist knowledge. There are a huge number of people that can manage doing a spreadsheet.
But more than that, the tools in a spreadsheet, as you get better and better, it's an easy entry point, and as you get better and better, at some point, you are programming. Like, that thing is a movement into programming. And, you know,
it's a gateway drug.
It's a gateway drug. And I believe very strongly, and I've said this before in different ways, but I believe very strongly that as our society is more and more managed by computers, the general ability to program is an elite position and a power position that if you don't move towards that, you are being controlled more than participating. Like, there is
it's a modern literacy.
Sure.
It's like saying...
It's like reading, yeah.
If you go through life and you don't know how to read, you can do it, but it's harder and your options are more limited.
And I would say 100 years ago, you can get through without reading. Yeah. And I think 50 years ago, you could kind of do it. There were some jobs and stuff.
Mm.
And that was pushing it.
Kind of pushing it.
And nowadays, really, if you're not
reading...
Actually,
1960s, you couldn't be illiterate.
Well, no, I'm sure there's people that were illiterate.
There are people
doing
who are
work
today who are illiterate,
yes,
functionally illiterate, but I don't believe that it is
a success situation,
now, you know, than it was
right
50 years
but
ago.
But do you believe that at some point programming will be as powerful as reading? I don't think it will be. But I think that the general idea that the society is managed by computers, and if you don't understand how they work, and you don't understand how you can how they function, you don't actually understand how the world is starting to function.
And then you end up with Star Wars.
How so?
Think carefully. How many times did you ever, in all the movies, in all of the canon, all of the, hell, the books, the animated series like Clone Wars and Rogue.
I'm familiar with the canon. It was a long time ago, but I know what it
is. Think of all the times do you remember someone actually reading something. I don't mean just like reading a couple of letters across something like a signage. I mean actually reading a document, a paragraph. In the movies, the only time, or actually,
well,
in
there's
all
definitely
of the
people
canon,
looking at screens, quite a bit of low level people looking at screens, but you're right, there might not be any reading on it.
The only time I can think of is when R2-D2 is speaking to Luke Skywalker as he's flying in the X-Wing going to Dagobah.
Well, what is Uncle Ben looking at when he's deciding whether to buy the things? He's looking at something in his hand.
Sorry?
Ben, when they're trying to decide what to get, doesn't he have something in his hand?
Trying to decide what to get.
Oh, when they're buying the droids.
No, Ben never buys. You mean Uncle Owen.
I'm sorry, Uncle Owen. Sorry. Okay.
Don't get all pedantic about it. This is important.
When they're buying the droids, and Owen's doing some negotiation, does he just have money in his hand, or is he?
I think that was just money.
I think you're right. I think it's just money.
No one reads and writes except for droids. The Death Star plans are in graphics.
Wow.
You never see writing.
Here's another one. Who is it that's flying the ship?
Yeah, there is an alphabet there, but you never see a lot of stuff.
Right, there's street signs and stuff.
Right, like the holocrons when they're in the Jedi Council. When he's asking about, you know, he's missing a planet.
Okay. Hang on a second, though. There is, in episode two, there is the library, and there's tons of books. And there are people in the library, and they're looking at books.
Are they actually looking at books? Because
There's a lot of people in that
room.
He's walking through the room. No, the little trainees aren't and all that. But when he goes in there and he's walking through, there's obviously people in there looking at books, right?
Not necessarily.
It's right that all that the librarian, all they look at is the star charts and stuff. They don't look at anything else. That's disturbing. Okay, I remember hearing a story about the same buttons being used all the time for different things. Like, and I think it... What's the chrome ship called that in episode one?
I don't recall.
Okay, I think flying that thing, you just always push the same button and it takes you where you want to go. Anyways, we're not into Star Wars lore as much as we should be to have that conversation. Can we please now talk about iOS 11?
One of the things that we've talked about as a recurring concern on this show is... Where is that line with regard to the Fourth Amendment and the fingerprint scanners, the thumbprint scanners?
How are you going to connect the Fourth Amendment and fingerprint scanners?
Because the Fourth Amendment says you are secure in your persons, in your papers, and to ask for a passcode or a PIN lock has been ruled by the courts as a different thing than the police grab your phone, they grab your hand, and they put your thumb onto the thumbprint, and your phone's unlocked.
Okay, granted. At the same time, if you had your documents with you in paper form, they can look through them, can't they?
That is actually an open
because of the Fourth?
Yeah, if your purse is closed, for example, or if your wallet is closed, I don't know that is protected by the Fourth Amendment. They would need a warrant for a probable cause.
Unless they think there's some kind of drug system in there that they want to look through.
That's probable cause.
I see. So if you have
a reasonable suspicion,
if I had one of those journals, like those kids' journals that have a little lock on the side, and I like had it locked and I had it with me through customs, they theoretically can't. Well, not customs because they have different rights, but police can't actually look in my locked journal.
I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to answer that. However, things have become a bit more interesting with regard to iOS 11, the next version of the iPhone app or iPhone and iPad. Operating system, which is if you touch the power button, the one on the side on newer phones, top on the older ones, if you hit it five times in quick succession, it will bring up an emergency screen, and it'll be just like when you reboot your phone that you can't use the Touch ID. You
it
have to auto
locks the phone.
Yeah, you have to put the passcode in to get in.
That's awesome.
So if you ever find yourself in a sticky situation,
five times press.
Hit it five times really fast. Now, first, way, update your phone, and then hit it five times really fast.
And don't have an iPhone 5 because they don't get updated to 11, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So you have to have an iPhone 6 or above.
5S or above.
5S or above. Okay. Anything with a touch ID.
The 64-bit CPUs.
Anything with a touch ID as well.
Yes, anything with a touch ID. So, I guess a 5, yeah, you're safe because you don't have to worry about it. It's always a touch. It's always,
well, unless you don't have your stuff in, unless you don't have it set up. So that's to make it such that you're now back in this place where they can't coerce you to, for your knowledge. So we've covered different stories.
Right.
If it's a password, they're asking for knowledge you have, and you can plead the fifth. Mm-hmm. But for fingerprint, of course, they can take your fingerprint. So, of course, they can take your fingerprint and put it on the phone. Even if they don't use your finger to do that, they could take your fingerprint and theoretically do it, but they don't have to. So this alleviates the need to accidentally do the wrong finger many times.
Right. And this seems very much like a move that Apple did as a specific response to the changing legal climate.
Speaking of the power button on the phone, I noticed that people around me don't always use it. They just let their phone go to sleep afterwards. So they pull out their phone, they do their thing, they check it, then they put their phone in their pocket. I always put it to sleep when I'm putting it away because I don't want it to sit in my pocket and go to sleep automatically at some point or accidentally dial.
I don't want to use up the battery. That's why I'm always doing it.
Exactly. So you can just always push the power button. The other thing is if you have a headphones or Bluetooth connected to a phone call and you're on the phone and you have a means of listening, you can push the sleep button or the power button is what people call it, but it's really the sleep button most of the time. And that won't disconnect your phone call. If you're on the phone and you don't have an audio device plugged in, you're just pushing it up to your head and you push that button, it will hang you up. So slight differences, but that's why the differences. Didn't matter to you that I said that, huh?
No, that's good information.
Another piece of good information, they have a fix in iOS 11. They had a bit of a problem. This is Apple again. They had a bug that allowed just a cracking tool to get into the data of the phone through, only when you had a four-digit PIN set. But effectively, a $500 password cracking box would open an iPhone prior to iOS 11, or more than that, a beta of iOS 11 had this bug. iOS 11 does not have this bug. They fixed it, and it was only in the beta, and it was only for iPhone 7 and iPhone 7 Plus, but it is interesting to see that emerge. And there's a whole video about this, and it might be fake, but I think it's real. It's one of those things where there's the claim, there's a good article, TechCrunch is covering it, so it feels right. At the same time, I know that Apple invests a lot of time and energy, and a lot of people make spoof videos about cracking it. So there's the story. In any case, not a big deal if you update to iOS 11 when it does come out. And also, don't use a four-digit code. Use a longer code because four digits just not enough anyway, and you're going to use your fingerprint most of the time to unlock it. Miles, tell me about Google's new policy about AIs or using AIs for bullying.
There's a new AI out there, and it's meant to combat bullying, so to categorize bullying statements.
How would it do such a thing? Bayesian filtering?
It's magic. It's AI. Now, this comes into play with what we were talking about on several previous shows, which is if you make the model based upon our existing society.
When you say model, you mean AI model, right?
An AI model, yes. A training corpus. That it's going to reflect that society, not necessarily do an ideal. It's going to be based upon...
Yes, it's not like it's some moral authority. It's just using what's acceptable in our society and using that as a basis.
Right. And so while the bullying AI seems like a great idea, the implementation of it doesn't seem quite as effective as one might like.
How so?
For example, the bullying AI is very good at catching profanity. But doesn't really capture context as well as one might like. For example, if you say, "This is awesome," it's on a scale of 0 to 100%, 100% being this is abusive information and 0, this is nothing. "This is awesome" ranks up at something like 3%. It could go either way, but I mean, as a probability, it's very low probability that it's bullying. However, if you say it's effing awesome, it suddenly shoots up to 98%.
Wait, why would that be more bullying? Like,
because you're using profanity. That's what the AI filter is going for. So
the thing is, I can bully you without using profanity.
Exactly. This is the curious thing about the anti-bullying AI, is that it mistakes, and this is actually true of a lot of people I've found when talking about, for example, racism in society, mistakes civility for decency.
Mm. Not the same thing.
Civility is you're not using profanity, you're trying to form a cogent argument, you are, you know, yeah, it's your choice of words is carefully measured. Decency, however, is a bit more ephemeral.
Hmm.
For example, another example here is you could say, you know, women are not as smart as men. It's arguably civil.
But it's bullying.
But
or horrible.
It's not decent. That would be found to be 4% likely to be it's considered by the AI 4% likely to be toxic.
Well, but okay, but first off, when you make a statement that depending on who you're talking to, that's not actually a bullying statement.
That's the thing, though. Just because you're being polite doesn't mean that your words aren't harmful.
Well,
and
harmful
for women
and bullying
to be told you're not as smart as men,
that's bullying. Is it bullying? Oh God, it's so hard. What do you think of the definition of bullying is?
Oh, that's a tough one.
Because it's kind of like an attack. It's making someone feel the way you want them to feel, or makes them feel uncomfortable. So in that sense, it's bullying. I think you can be a complete jerk to me, and I wouldn't call it bullying. You could also be bullying me, and you could be doing it politely. So
well,
it's like there
also,
are different
we're
things.
Also on the same level with regard to power.
Except for my high intelligence.
Mm. But we are peers. There's no power inequity in our statements, and therefore it's a lot easier to have, you know, an insult roll off our backs,
right,
and just be like, yeah, whatever, that's banter. This does not seem to take into account a power inequity, especially power inequities that are inherent in our society.
Hmm.
Now, for example, another example here, men are biologically superior to women. You could also say something like, genocide is good.
See, these are horrible statements, but
yes, and they rank low on Google's AI for toxicity.
Toxicity of
statement. That's what they're saying as
okay,
a metric
okay.
for bullying.
Okay,
now,
wait a second.
If you say F off without actually using letters as a euphemism for it, or a replacement, that comes off as 100%. So if you use this AI for online conversation, if you use it for Facebook or something like that,
it doesn't do anything. It just makes
polite. You end up with someone being truly toxic in the conversation, getting away scot-free, and the person getting frustrated by it and reacting,
getting
banned.
Oh, yeah, that's really interesting. Because, of course, you take that stance of being like, oh, hi, I'm being very respectful, and I think you're a horrible person. And, you know, that
yeah.
kind of language.
And it wouldn't surprise me if something that's similar to this was at play at Twitter, at Facebook.
Oh, interesting.
Because I have seen people.
They probably
Some of it is crowdsourced, and I'm sure they're doing from there. But they also, I'm sure, have heuristics as well.
Mm-hmm.
And those heuristics are what are they going to be based on?
Do you think this is a very tough AI problem?
Yes, it is difficult. I mean, yes. Absolutely, it is.
I don't see why this is a machine learning problem. This just sounds like a Bayesian filter thing. Like, use these words, you've got a problem. Like, I don't see why this is. Do they have a large corpus of what people have classified as bullied versus
not? But the thing
not?
Is, you're putting in those training, what you choose to train it from, and what you expect the answer to be, that result,
sure,
is going to be biased.
Yeah, I agree. But don't we have a lot of data on people being jerks that have been banned from message boards and what the kind of language they used? I mean, it seems like you'd have a better training set that understand that this is effing awesome.
But
is
you
a
have
good
to remember
to
who the trainers are. Now, you are correct, but you also have to keep in mind, for example, with Twitter, when people say, well, how do you actually block out Nazis from saying something, even if they are being, you know, horrible people? In France and in Germany, they do block Nazis. So when you look at it, if you look in the U.S. at something, you'll see a whole series of these abusive tweets and or just toxic from the point of view of what we're talking about is toxic, not mm-hmm. what the AI considers toxic.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at it through a VPN going through France or Germany, those tweets are actually being filtered by Twitter. They've already identified them. They just aren't applying the filter to the U.S. audience.
But are those filters in Germany that take out – I mean, of course, it's illegal to
the same tweets, Nazis the exact same tweets.
That. Yeah, but the tweets themselves, what is it? Are they saying effing awesome and in Germany they're not being blocked and here they would be blocked? Or is it more like very clearly supporting Nazi?
I've never known anyone for saying effing awesome get blocked on Twitter.
Well,
before,
no, nobody gets blocked. Yeah. I've always thought that nobody got blocked on Twitter. But I thought it was just keyword searching in Germany where like you mention, you know.
No, it's the account.
Oh, the account gets canceled if they're
They're not canceled. They have this is the account. And you see the little photo, and they say this tweet is unavailable according to rules of France. Or
the
Germany.
Account or the account or the post.
The post.
Okay, so what I'm saying is, a person says, "I don't believe the Holocaust exists in Germany. That didn't happen." That gets removed because they mention the word Holocaust and some kind of not belief.
I misspoke for what you're describing.
Yeah.
The account itself has been blocked because it is by someone who does this behavior on a regular basis.
So they've identified the account and stopped it.
Yes.
Because it's illegal in that country.
But only in
– But I guess what I'm saying is I asked you earlier if you thought that this was a hard problem. I think it's an exceptionally hard problem. And this has to do with general intelligence is extremely challenging. Like one of the reasons why we don't have general AI AI mm-hmm. is that what we learn as a human being affects how we think about the world so much so that you can't think like we think without growing up.
Not a hard problem. What I'm saying is that it's a hard problem and I don't have real faith that the people who are training the algorithms are actually addressing the problem.
I mean, they've never identified the problem in the first place, so how can you have a data set, a corpus, that actually identifies the problem?
Well, they're solving a different problem. They're solving the profanity problem.
Right. Well,
If you're saying it's a bullying API,
it's not about profanity. Profanity shouldn't even enter into it. It's a different thing.
Right.
And that's the thing that I don't get.
Profanity is an amplifier. So if you are being toxic and you use profanity, that's an amplifying statement over the civil discussion. I do believe that.
I'm just not very sensitive to profanity. Like I don't think of profanity by itself. The vocabulary words themselves have, there's a few of them do have too much weight behind them because the thought they incur is so horrible. But there's a lot of our profanity words, like almost all the standard ones that are, you know, the seven bad ones that are scanned. Only one of those in my mind actually has a too much meat to it to cause it to be profane. I think there's.
Now, when you say you don't really react to profanity, now let me say, you know, one of your children is doing a task and the person that's administering the task, like a manager or whatever, say they have a job, says, "This is substandard." Would you feel it has the same effect to you as saying, "This is substandard," or the person saying to your child, I'm trying to get an emotional response here. That's why I'm bringing up children.
Yeah, sure.
"This is effing substandard."
It brings more weight, but so does this.
It's an amplifier.
This is extremely substandard.
Yeah.
But that, to me, doesn't even sound like bullying. It's not even that bad. What would sound bad to me would be, "You're a worthless human being." Like, that statement is much more.
And that's where the profanity straddles that line, I think. I think in that context of an employer using the profanity to someone in a.
I think profanity denotes the lack of the enhanced emotion of the speaker as a more emotionally charged thing. But if this person is screaming and they're saying, "This is substandard," and they're not swearing, that's as powerful as them calmly saying it with the swear word. To me, the swear word denotes the lack of decorum and therefore the heightened emotion and therefore the visceral body danger aspect of high anger and emotion.
Right, but we are talking about online content, and that's pretty much written word.
And potentially, online content, the only way you can show severe emotion is by using profanity. So that kind
emojis,
of makes sense.
Capital letters.
Can you denote anger? I guess you can have some.
All caps is totally shouting.
Totally. I've got somebody in my life that uses all caps just all the time with every email. And I just don't. I've even told him. I'm like, why are you shouting at me? It's like maybe their phone just does that automatically. They got like an old phone. So frustrating. Well, so the bullying AI is not so good.
In this person's opinion.
All right. Well, we have one more story of the day. Please do sing a song for me, would you?
Nope, because then you'll know where I am. This story is about injecting high-frequency tones into common pop songs and using those high-frequency tones as a form of echolocation. So in a song that, you know, you're just listening, you know, some Michael Jackson song's playing, you don't think anything of it. Oh, stop.
No, come on. You got to think of one.
The Way You Make Me Feel.
Okay.
This song has been altered. All you know is that it's a Michael Jackson song playing. And you're enjoying yourself, kind of grooving to it.
As you do.
As you do. And at the same time, if they have a mic on it, they can use those high tones that have been put injected into that song to track your position
in the room,
your posture within the room as well.
Okay, so of course the pop song has almost nothing to do with it except to mask that the high frequency tones are being played.
Exactly.
Because of course the high frequency tones are going to be lower in volume such that your auditory system, even if you could hear them normally, will be not be able to listen to them because we have an automatic gain control in our auditory system.
Our stereos, the speakers generally aren't good enough to get tones that we can't hear.
Yeah, right, exactly. So the speakers are going to have the tones are going to be in the audio range, but they'll be masked in the song, and they'll be masked in such a way that it'll probably go with the song, so you won't actually hear the tone. But using that, it's like echolocation if they've got a mic in the room. That's kind of cool. I mean, it's not really a privacy concern because, heck, there's a mic in your room. I mean, you have other problems.
Well, what about if you take it from the point of view of remote microphones, ones that, you know, point
long
against
distance.
The wall?
Yeah, that's true.
Pointing against the wall, and then you just set it up so you're playing music in a certain area
to
be able to track movements.
Online streaming services, are they all encrypted on their music? Could you like?
In general, they are.
Interesting.
For license purposes, but who knows? Maybe it's a sting operation.
You knocked me off of my feet now, baby.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know we made it. This is GeekSpeak episode 30 of season 17, and with me today was Mr. Miles Elam. Hey, Miles. Thanks for being here today.
Always a pleasure.
I'm Lyle Troxell, and Greg Merkley gave us the title of the show, Maine Votes to Watermark Bullying. Not bad. Thank you so much, Greg. If you'd like to listen to more of our episodes of this program or learn more about our program or participate in supporting our program, please visit geekspeak.org/support.
Hey, pretty baby with the high heels on. You're messy, but like I'm never...
The theme song today is by Michael Jackson. No? You don't think I should use Michael Jackson?
No, go for it.
Great. All right. The beginning of the theme, the first theme song is by Michael Newman. The second theme song is by Michael Jackson.